the Living Dialogues programs, I think, are amongst the most important radio programs that are out there because they foster well-being. And because of what you are doing, other people hear this and are influenced to do similarly. And that kind of work is, that is the work of well-being. That is how you create social transformation. And so your 25 years of doing this and these multiple programs that you've done that emphasize this aspect is one of the important parts of work being done to preserve democracy and to foster well-being. And I hope that you continue to do the Living Dialogue programs for many more years.
Welcome to this special program of Living Dialogues. This is actually part two of a program I've done with my friend Stefan Schwartz that played on the Friday Connections program on March 11. And that whole part one is full of very interesting insights. It's a really excellent dialogue. And as I said, Stefan is like a kind of polymath in so many different fields, a real modern Renaissance man with experience both in consciousness and science and politics and society. And our interests are very similar, as you have heard here on Living Dialogues for these last 25 years. And Stefan, one of the things he's been doing for 25 years is putting out the Schwartz Report on a daily basis, where he brings together from his continual research and deep reading certain articles that he's tracking that represent trends. As I say, creating, especially out of the pandemic, for potentially a kind of post-COVID renaissance, just as happened with the Black Plague, and it did a complete reset on European economic structures and the feudal system, and opened the door for the craft and, we might say, the merchant class to emerge, and the whole flowering of the Renaissance. So one of the things that I keep in mind, myself and Stefan and I have talked about, even as early as the summer of 2018, Stefan and I did a series of co-visioning on how we could move to a wise and compassionate society dedicated to well-being and the good of all, common good and well-being, which are really hallmarks of all Stefan's work very specifically. And democracy, we are both warriors for democracy and realize that the substance of our American democracy is under great and unparalleled threat. I say it's the biggest threat, not since the Civil War, but from the Revolutionary War, because that's what started the fight for democracy. It was a 7-year war after the Declaration of Independence, and then created the Constitution after a couple of years and embarked on the experiment in democracy, but starting from a top-down revolution, if you will, of, as we described in the first part of part one, an oligarchic patriarchy, plutocracy. Also happened to be in the patriarchy what would not have been called at the time white supremacism, but actually amounted to that, because in our original constitution, there were no rights whatsoever for Indians. The black people, the people of color, the slaves had been converted into 3/5 of a person, not to have a vote, but to count toward expanding the power of the plantation owner for bigger representation within Congress. And so we also remarked on the fact that women did not have the vote and didn't get that until 1920. And what we're doing in this series is weaving together our crisis of democracy, which is the biggest crisis of American substantive democracy in our entire history, as we are having the media, quite appropriately, day by day, covering the catastrophic attack by an autocrat. Autocracy meaning the rule by a single individual. And we have Vladimir Putin attacking viciously and in total war crime manner day after day the country of Ukraine. And so how that resolves itself, many people feel we won't know for months, but it will reset in some way what the relations are between Europe, Russia, China, really the whole world order as we've known it. Now, one of the things I want to remark on here in the beginning is that China has now sided with Russia in the sense that Russia has been, and the words of Russians that are known to myself and to Stefan personally, has been lied to for 20 full years by Vladimir Putin. And now he has such control over the media in Russia that the great majority of people in Russia have no choice but to believe the big lie. The big lie is so outrageous that it says things like the Russian soldiers are there to liberate the Ukrainians from their domination by the Nazis, exemplified by President Zelensky, who, of course, is Jewish and so on. So these are examples in our modern day of what happened with Hitler in the last century. Goebbels was talking about if you're going to tell a lie, tell a really big, outrageous lie, and then tell it over and over again, and people will then believe it. And that is happening in Russia. But what's really concerning now, also to keep an eye on, is that China is resending out under its state broadcast system these same lies to hundreds of millions of Chinese people to believe that Russia is not the aggressor and so on. So those two have kind of joined forces. We think that China has its own interests at stake here. Putin is going to be very dependent on them for a very long time under these circumstances. And I think they want to be in the driver's seat, as they always have, China as an imperial power and the the head of government, you might say, in the imperial palace there in China was always called the cosmic pivot in the days of tributaries where people would come and offer tribute like Marco Polo to get the business of China. They see themselves as the world dominant culture for many, many centuries now, and they're making a big comeback. Now, I want to finally put this in the context of where we could move into a very bleak future, a dystopia as foreseen very, very specifically by George Orwell back in 1949 when he wrote his book 1984. And what he saw was that, and this is even before Mao won in China in 1949, that's when the book was published, but what he saw was that China would be the dominating geopolitical military force throughout all of Asia by 1984, and we're just doubled the time now. Instead of 35 years, it's 70 years now, and we're moving into its realization, and some of its aspects are already in place. But he saw also that Russia, with its czarist authoritarian tradition, would be dominant in all of Europe. And we've seen now that unless Europe makes strong steps to get off oil and gas and all of the conflict and wars and instability that that industry has been responsible for, their dependency on Russia is making their boycotting to the extent that they can not as strong and effective as it could be because they've integrated their own energy system dependence with Russia. Now, as we have said before, Russia is not only a one-trick pony with its 2,850 million people, economy is less than that of Texas. And really what they, in great quantity and dominate the world, they have 6,000 of the 13,000 nuclear weapons that exist in the world. And the other 9,000 are divided among nine different countries. But the two main nuclear powers are the United States and Russia. And he's been using that bullying tactic to threaten, gee, if you really get here into our skies and try to escalate, in our view, this conflict, well, then we're going to war with you. And he's brandishing the possibility that he might, in his either feigned or actual craziness, listening only to the voices inside his own head, he might actually be serious about this. And this is a tactic he's used before. And so what we're trying to do here is to show in this series, part one, There's an hour-long program that's available at kgnu.org/connections for March 11. And this program, Living Dialogues, that will be archive accessible at kgnu.org/Living Dialogues for today's date. And we've been intertwining the huge crisis of democracy, which has been backburnered by our corporate media even before what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, because our corporate media has a stake in continuing the oligarchic, plutocratic, de facto system that governs the United States. And it is on the verge of concentrating power in all three systems of our government. The Supreme Court is now in the hands of radical right-wing Republicans that are wanting to take all of our elections and even the choice of electors for president and put it in the hands exclusively of state legislatures, not the government, not their constitution in the state, not the courts in the state, but exclusively in the legislatures, which they know, especially in all the swing states, are dominated by gerrymandered Republican majorities that are only going to be more gerrymandered as we now move into the next decennial period, having just did a census. And they really came on strong after Citizens United in January of 2010. And we're ready with all the dark money then to win 1,000 seats in state legislatures in the 2010 election. And so that is now, again, their game plan, despite January 6th and all of the terrible things that everybody saw of the attempted coup by Trump and his minions, and also the violence that took place, even to the point of urinating and defecating inside our national capital. That's been reported on many times, and it seems not to in any way put off the maggot base of Donald Trump. And the big lie that he's come up with is extraordinarily dangerous, just like the big lie of propaganda that Putin is putting on in Russia and is being embraced and amplified by China. Because when people don't have access to the truth and the facts, something that both I and Stefan are really, those are our lodestars in all of our work, then situations become really potentially violent, ungovernable. Conflict is manipulated by the autocratic people at the top, Imperial China, Tsarist Russia with Xi Jinping, now essentially an emperor for life. And the same thing with Putin, who's allowed to now stay in office unless he's removed until 2036. So that's just sort of laying the table here. Now I'm going to invite Stefan to come on and first address some of these issues from the point of view of what's going on the world stage. Later on, I'm going to invite him to talk about why the same kind of propaganda, sinister and highly dangerous situation is happening in our own country with over a third of the people believing the big lie with a, you might say, internet-driven social media governed by uncontrollable monster-type algorithms that actually move false information 7 times faster than the truth. It goes back 3 centuries now to Jonathan Swift when he said, "The lies fly on wings, and a long time later, the truth hobbling along comes in to view, but often too late." And so that's how the algorithms are set up, to give false information, to stimulate people's emotional anger, and then get involved with, quote, engagement with their devices, which is where all the money comes from, and get into endless comment loops, conspiracy theories, and all the rest of it. So this is the terrain where I think the great crisis of American democracy, will it survive or will it move to autocracy, is going to be fought out, especially when the corporate media are not making the kind of presentations that I'm making here and Stefan is making here and that we both made in part one of this dialogue. Our program, it's entitled The Future, Democracy or Autocracy, Here and Abroad. stressing the fact it's not just something happening thousands of miles away with Putin attacking Ukraine. Ukraine is fighting for its democracy in a way that is every bit as noble and even more determined than our original American revolution, where many people stayed on the sidelines and it took a very long time to prevail. And as Washington said, there were acts of providence with a capital P, he said, along the way, without which we would certainly have lost the war. So, Stephen, I invite you to just jump in. Maybe you could talk just as an entree, where I said in part one that I had been on the barricades in the street outside the Parliament building where Yeltsin was holed up when people were trying to arrest him and depose him as the first elected official in Russian history. He'd been elected mayor and then elected president of Russia, and they wanted to depose him. There was a coup that happened in the same modality when Khrushchev was basically kidnapped in Solshi, the Black Sea resort, where he was on vacation and replaced by hardliners, to the point where Khrushchev actually is the only Russian leader that is not buried in the Kremlin. He had too many liberal tendencies, and they wanted to go back to the Stalin hard man situation, and the people rebelled. It turns out, Stefan and I just found this out recently, that while I was down on the barricades, the only foreigner that I saw, the only American I saw, he was in Russia for one of his many trips of citizen diplomacy, and he was in the upper floors of the Ukraine Hotel across the river from the Parliament building, looking down on, unknowingly, myself and seeing all of the young men that were holding the fort. And because of that, the special forces in Russia decided not to try to do an assault. They didn't want blood on their hands. And that very night of August 21, the Russian old guard fled, and democracy for the moment prevailed. But what was very interesting is that when Stefan was there in the upper floors of the Ukraine Hotel, he was calling in CNN to come and report on this spontaneous event. And I, on the ground, watched the cameraman loaded up with all his equipment, the only other American I saw, a guy from CNN, you know, rushing into the crowd to make reporting. So with those memories here, Stefan, I'd like you to maybe just begin talking about what's happening now in Russia and the Ukraine from the perspective of your lifetime attempt and interest, not only to do citizen diplomacy in Russia, but actually to help create democracy in Russia. And we came very, very close. I was told on the barricades by one of the lieutenants who was about 30 years old, after we prevailed on that night and the people fled, the old guard fled at the airport. He said, "You are from America and you have a great democracy, which we aspire to, and we here in Russia are very, very proud of our revolution." And I said, "I feel really privileged to be here and taking part in your revolution, and I will bring this passion and fight and spirit, which are now seen in Ukraine, back to the somewhat comfortable and moribund democracy even then in 1991 with George H.W. Bush that is in America. I'm very inspired by your great courage and fight and celebrating what I think could be a worldwide revolution for democracy." That's what we thought in those days. And that's what Leonard Cohen said in his 1992, the year after, album called The Future, "Democracy is coming to the USA." So those are many perspectives I put on the table. Enter wherever you like, Stefan, because I know you've got wonderful stories, even right now, about people you're in contact with, Russia, which was a great passion of your life to help it become a democracy.
Well, I think the important thing is, when during the period of glasnost and perestroika, when the opportunity existed, the reticence or the resistance on the American side was they couldn't get past their Cold War thinking. Putin reached out to the United States, as is well documented, to in hopes at that point of seeing if they could create a democracy, but he got rebuffed because the establishment in the U.S. just couldn't get past Cold War thinking. And there were, amongst the major corporate figures, there were really only two people that I saw who were making an effort, and that was Don Kendall, who was then the chairman of PepsiCo, and George Soros, who, of course, the right hates. But in fact, George Soros pumped millions of dollars into Russia, ultimately without much effect, in order to help them try to create a democracy. I mean, the thing you always have to remember about Russia is that, except for about 10 years, Russia has always been an autocracy. The czars and then Stalin and the communists, and it is the function of the culture has been structured to support autocracies. So I think that is an important thing to know. I tried, along with other people, to create what we call citizen diplomacy, which was a kind of second channel, a second way. And we got artists and psychiatrists and psychologists and had meetings between them. And I created an art exchange, which put on the first American-Russian art exhibit and all kinds of things to try to make that work. But ultimately, it didn't. And the reason was, in part, because the United States did not really move as it should have, and as I think people in retrospect wish they had, did not really respond because we were still, as I said, trapped in this kind of Cold War thinking about, because there had been so many years in which Russia and the United States had been in this sort of mutually assured destruction, Cold War. The other thing that's going on, I think, that requires close attention is that not just in Russia, where the free press has now been closed down and most people are getting the only news they get is what comes out of the state. I saw an interview the other night about a guy who had talked to his father in Russia while he was in the Ukraine, and his father simply would not believe that what his son was telling him could be true. Oh, no, the Russians couldn't possibly be doing those things that you're describing. And while he was describing them, bombs were going off in the background. And the son said, "Can you hear them?" And the father said, "Yes, yes, but it can't possibly be Russians. They wouldn't do things like that." But worldwide, and I think this is not getting a lot of attention, there has been a fundamental change in the dynamics of both internal and geopolitical affairs that has arisen because of the internet and social media and the fact that many people, perhaps most people in some cases, get their information without any real checking as to whether it's accurate or not. And even worse than that, the autocrats have figured out, it's interesting, it's in the United States, the plutocrats, the oligarchs, have been funding scientists who were willing to go along with this, looking at how do you manipulate people, the sort of psychophysiology of politics. And one of the things that they understood was that you manipulate information by providing misinformation. And so you have organizations like Fox or InfoWars or Newsmax, which are essentially propaganda operations. I mean, the Murdoch family knows exactly what they're doing. It was interesting during the pandemic period when they were talking about why vaccination was not necessary. They were requiring all of their people to get vaccinated. So what they do and what they say are not at all the same thing. and they do not base what they purvey as being factual. I mean, they claim it is, but they know perfectly well that it's not. And this is going on in all over the world, and the wealthy who control the media companies are manipulating it and altering the nature of media in the world, so that getting fact-based information is much harder than you would imagine. I mean, there in the United States, there are still companies that do this, but there are a growing number of media that are controlled by people whose real interest is not getting out fact-based news, but it's in creating consciousness attitudes. And it has been extraordinarily effective. I mean, I think I may have mentioned this, but if not, let me say it again. There's I'd give you a specific again fact. 2019, one poll did a survey and found that 11% of respondents have never left the state in which they were born, and 54% have visited fewer than 10 states. So the United States is a very provincial country. I mean, you don't think of it that way, but the truth is most people have never actually traveled widely. And further complicating that is the fact that in the United States, we have not had major social violence since 1864. And so most Americans have absolutely no idea what a fascist autocracy would really be like. And therefore, we have a large percentage, about a third of the country, who, let me give you another fact. This is amazing stuff. The Public Religion Research Institute in 2021 did a survey, and they found over 30 million Americans believe in QAnon's conspiracy theory that the government, media, the financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who are running a global child sex trafficking operation involving Hillary Clinton. Now, you would think that nobody would believe that, but quite the contrary. 30%, 30 million Americans, that's about 11% of the country, believe this. One of the things that we need to focus on is the nurturing of democracy, because democracy requires agreement. It requires consensus. The founders, for all their limitations, understood that. And we are seeing our democracy damaged. I mean, the other day, Representative Cawthorn from North Carolina described Zelensky as a thug, and that the whole thing that was going on was not at all what was actually going on, but that Zelensky was evil. And now we have this. The other thing that I'm beginning to see more and more of is that there's some biochemical plant the United States and the Ukraine were running to create chemical warfare. Now, it's interesting that this has come up at this time, because I think this is exactly what the Russians are thinking about. The thing about the autocrat fascist community is that they always telegraph what they're going to do by claiming somebody else is doing it. So when you hear stuff that is ought to be seen as preposterous and yet is believed by people, you need to ask yourself, what is the real factual basis? And you can find it out. You can do a Google. You can go to Google Scholar. You can go to PubMed. There are lots of ways to get good fact-based information. And our democracy hangs by a thread because so many people in this country have been manipulated into believing utter nonsense.
and be with us next week for the concluding part three of this program, The Future, Democracy or Autocracy, Here and Abroad, with myself and Stefan Schwartz. See you then.
KGNU Boulder, Denver, with translators K229AC, Nederland, K254CH, Laporte, and K256CT, Denver, Colorado.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The International Red Cross says time is running out to prevent a worst-case scenario in the besieged southern Ukrainian port of Mariupol. It's called on all sides as a matter of urgency to ensure hundreds of thousands of trapped people get access to life-saving humanitarian aid and agree a concrete plan for their evacuation. Danny Eberhard reports.
The head of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, said the life-or-death nightmare facing people in Mariupol needed to end now. Residents face extreme or total shortages of food, water and medicine. The city council says the Russian bombardment has killed more than 2,100 people. The Ukrainian authorities blame Russia for repeatedly blocking attempts to provide humanitarian relief or evacuate the citizens. Moscow denies this.
Russia has said it killed a large number of what it called foreign mercenaries and destroyed a consignment of foreign weapons in an attack on the sprawling Yavoriv military base in western Ukraine. Ukrainian officials said at least 35 people died. The base near the border with Poland was hit early on Sunday. The BBC's Hugh Bachega is there.
We've seen about 10 ambulances leaving the area. There's around two dozen parked here. Poland. It's just 20 kilometers or 12 miles on that direction. And of course, Poland has been essential for the Ukrainians in this war because of the flow of weapons coming through the border. And just yesterday, Russia said it could target the shipment of arms being sent by the West. So today's events could mark a significant escalation in this war.
Despite Moscow's continuing attacks, negotiators from both sides have given their most optimistic assessments of the talks aimed at ending the violence. Ukraine said the Russians were beginning to engage constructively. The Russians have also spoken of significant progress. With more on the diplomatic efforts, here's James Landale.
Russian and Ukrainian officials held three rounds of talks on the Belarus border and failed to reach any agreement. But since last week, they've spoken regularly by video link and are now sounding more optimistic. Mykhailo Podolyak, a Ukrainian negotiator, said Russia was no longer issuing ultimatums and was beginning to talk constructively. But neither side would say where progress, if any, had been made, whether on humanitarian issues or even the possibility of a ceasefire.
Russian police have arrested anti-war protesters in Moscow and St. Petersburg. The French news agency said its reporters saw police detain at least a dozen protesters in the capital and multiple arrests in Russia's second city. The Human Rights Monitoring Group, OVD, says there were more than 800 arrests in three dozen cities. There are no official figures. World news from the BBC. An American journalist has been shot dead outside Kyiv. Police said Brent Renault was targeted by Russian soldiers in Irpin, a suburb that's been the scene of intense fighting. Speaking from the hospital where he was being treated for his wounds, another journalist, Juan Arredondo, who was with Renault, said their car was fired on.
We crossed the first bridge in Irpin. We're going to film other refugees leaving, and we got into a car. Somebody offered to take us to the other bridge, and we crossed a checkpoint, and they start shooting at us. So the driver turned around, and they kept shooting. It's two of us. My friend is Brent Renault, and he's been shot and left behind.
Brent Renaud was an award-winning filmmaker who also covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The number of people known to have died in a train crash in the Democratic Republic of Congo on Thursday